Pulled his sword, taking part in battles in the disputed lands, then founded one of the newer free companies of the East, the Windblown.
For most of its history, slavery was widely practiced in Pentos, and Pentoshi ships played an active role in the slave trade. Several centuries ago, however, this practice brought the city into conflict with her northern neighbor, Braavos, the bastard daughter of Valyria, founded by a fleet of escaped slaves. Over the course of the last 200 years, no less than 6 wars have been fought between the two cities over this issue, and it must be pointed out, for control of the rich lands and waters that lie between them. 4 of these ended in Braavos' victory and Pentoshi's submission. The last of them concluded 190 years ago, went so poorly for Pentos that no fewer than 4 princes were chosen and sacrificed within the span of a single year. The 5th man in this bloody succession, Prince Nevio Norates, convinced the magisters to sue for peace after a rare victory, one it was rumored that Nevio purchased by means of bribes. In the peace accords, Pentos was forced to make certain concessions, most notably the abolition of slavery and a withdrawal from the slave trade. These provisions remain the law in Pentos to this day, though certain observers have noted that many Pentoshi ships evade the prohibition against the slave trade by running Lycian or Mirish banners up their masts when challenged. Whilst in the city itself there are tens of thousands of free bond servants who seem to be slaves in all but name, for they are collared and branded, much like their counterparts in Lys, Myr, and Tyrosh, and subject to similar savage disciplines. In law, these bond servants are free men and women, with a right to refuse service as they will, provided they are not in debt to their masters. Almost all of them are, however, since the value of their labor is often less than the cost of the food, clothing, and shelter provided them by those they serve, so that their debt grows rather than diminishes over time. A further provision of the peace accords between Braavos and Pentos limits the Pentoshi to no more than 20 warships and prohibits them from hiring sellswords, entering into contracts with free companies, or maintaining any army beyond the city watch. Undoubtedly, these are among the reasons that the Pentoshi are now notably less belligerent than the people of Tyrosh, Myr, and Lys. Despite its massive walls, Pentos is often seen as the most vulnerable of the free cities. For this reason, the magisters have adopted a conciliatory attitude not only toward the other free cities, but also with the Dothraki horse lords, cultivating a precarious friendship with a series of strong carls over the years, and showering lavish gifts and chests of gold upon any who brought their calasars east of the Rhoyn. Valantis, the greatest, richest, and most powerful of the 9 free cities, are Braavos and Valantis. And there is a curious connection between the two, for in many ways they stand in opposition to one another. Braavos lies in the far north of Essos, and Valantis to the far south. Valantis is the oldest of the free cities, and Braavos the youngest. Braavos was founded by slaves, whilst Valantis is built upon their bones. Braavos' greatest might is at sea, whilst that of Valantis is upon the land. Yet both remain formidable powers. Their history is deeply marked by the freehold of Valyria. Ancient and glorious, old Valantis, as the city is often named, sprawls across one of the 4 mouths of the Rhoyn, where that mighty river flows into the summer sea. The older districts of the city lie upon the eastern banks, the newer on the west, but even the newest eras of Valantis are many centuries old. The 2 halves of the city are linked by the long bridge.
Many of the old blood of Valantis still keep the old gods of Valyria, but their faith is found primarily within the Black Walls. Without, the red god R'hllor is favored by many, especially among the slaves and freedmen of the city. The temple of the Lord of Light in Volantis is said to be the greatest in all the world. In Remnants of the Dragon Lords, Archmaester Gramion claims that it is fully 3 times larger than the Great Sept of Baelor. All who serve within this mighty temple are slaves, bought as children and trained to become priests, temple prostitutes, or warriors. These wear the flames of their fiery god as tattoos upon their faces. Of the warriors, little enough is said, though they are called the Fiery Hand, and they never number more or less than 1,000 members.
The heart of Old Volantis is the city within the city, an immense labyrinth of ancient palaces, courtyards, towers, temples, cloisters, bridges, and cellars, all contained within the great oval of the Black Walls, raised by the freehold of Valeria in the first flush of its youthful expansion. 200 feet tall and so thick that 6 4-horse chariots can race along their battlements side by side, as they do each year to celebrate the founding of the city. These seamless walls are fused black dragonstone, harder than steel or diamond, stand in mute testimony to Volantis' origins as a military outpost. Only those who can trace their ancestry back to Old Valyria are allowed to dwell within the Black Walls. No slave, freedman, or foreigner is permitted to set foot within, without the express invitation of a scion of the Old Blood. For the first century of its existence, Volantis was little more than a military outpost, established to protect the borders of the Valyrian Empire, with no inhabitants save the soldiers of its garrison. From time to time, dragon lords descended to take refreshment or meet with envoys from the Roynar cities upriver. Over time, however, taverns and brothels and stables began to sprout up outside the Black Walls, and merchant ships began to call as well. Blessed with a magnificent natural harbour and an ideal location at the mouth of the Rhône, Volantis began to grow rapidly. Homes and shops and inns spread up the east bank of the river and into the hills beyond the Black Walls, whilst across the Rhône on the west bank, the foreigners, freedmen, sellswords, criminals, and other less savoury elements threw up their own shadow city, where fornication, drunkenness, and murder held sway. And eunuchs, pirates, cut-purses, and necromancers mingled freely. In time, the lawless city of the West Bank became such a cesspit of crime and depravity that the Triarchs had no choice but to send their slave soldiers across the Rhône to restore order and some semblance of decency. Strong tides and treacherous shifting currents made the crossings difficult, however. So after some years, the Triarch Velasco the Munificent commanded that a bridge be built across the Rhône. Those same tides and currents, and the river's width, made the building an epic task, requiring more than 40 years and many millions of honours. Triarch Velasco did not live to see what he had wrought. But once completed, the Lung Bridge had no rivals, save for the Bridge of Dream in the Roynar festival city of Croyenne. Strong enough to support the weight of 1,000 elephants, or so it is claimed, the Lung Bridge of Volantis stands today as the longest bridge in all the known world. Lomas Lungstrider named it one of the 9 wonders made by man in his book of that title. For much of its early history, Volantis benefited from the trade between Valeria and the Roynar, waxing ever more prosperous and powerful. While Sahoy, the ancient and beautiful Rhoynish city that had previously dominated their commerce, suffered a corresponding decline. Inevitably, This led the two cities into conflict. The long series of wars that followed, the details of which have been recounted elsewhere, culminated with the utter destruction of the cities of the Rhône and the flight of Nymeria and her 10,000 ships. Though the dragon lords of Valeria won the victory, it is rightly said that Valantis was the principal beneficiary. Sahoy remains in ruins to this day, a desolate and haunted place, while Valantis, with its long bridge and black walls and huge arbor, ranks amongst the great cities of the world. Inside the black walls, Valentines of the old blood still keep court in ancient palaces, attended by armies of slaves. Outside, the foreigners, freedmen, and low-born of 100 nations may be found. Seafarers and traders swarm the city markets and harbors, together with slaves almost beyond count. It is said that in Valantis there are 5 slaves for every free man, a disproportion in numbers matched only by the ancient Gascari cities of Slaver's Bay. The custom in Valantis is that the faces of all slaves are to be tattooed, marked for life to show their status, and carrying that burden of the past even if they are freed. The styles of tattooing are many, and are sometimes disfiguring. The slave soldiers of Valantis wear green tiger stripes upon their faces, which denote their rank. Prostitutes are marked by a single tear beneath their right eye. The slaves that collect the dung of horses and elephants are marked with flies. Fools and jesters wear motley. The drivers of the hathes, the carts pulled by the small elephants of Valantis, are marked with wheels, and so on. Valantis is a freehold, and all freeborn landholders have a voice in the governance of the city. 3 triarchs are elected annually to administer her laws, command her fleets and armies, and share in the day-to-day rule of the city. The election of the triarchs occurs over the course of 10 days, in a process that is both festive and tumultuous. In recent centuries, the office has been dominated by 2 competing factions, unofficially known as the Tigers and the Elephants. Partisans of various candidates and of the 2 factions rally on behalf of their chosen leaders, dispensing favors to the populace. All freeborn landholders, even women, are granted a vote. Though the process strikes many outsiders as chaotic to the point of madness, power passes peacefully enough on most occasions.
Many Volantines regard themselves as the natural and rightful successors to the dragon lords of old Valeria, and desire to achieve dominance over the other free cities and, in time, the world. The Tigers advocate achieving this dominance through war and conquest, whereas the Elephants prefer a policy of trade and growing wealth.
After the doom engulfed Valeria and the lands of the Long Summer, Valantis asserted its right to rule over all the other Valerian colonies throughout the world. Such was the might of the First Daughter that for a time she succeeded in establishing hegemony over several of the other free cities during the Century of Blood. Eventually, the Volantine Empire collapsed of its own weight, brought down by an alliance of those sister cities that still remained free and the rebellion of those that had been subdued. Since that time, the Elephants, the more peaceable of the Volantine factions, have dominated the annual choosing and the office of triarch. Yet years of expansion under the Tigers gave Valantis control over several lesser cities, most notable amongst them the great river towns of Volantiris, Velasar, and Selhoris, each larger and more populous than King's Landing or Old Town. The Volantines also control the Rhône as far as the tributary river Selhoru, and hold sway over the Orange Coast to the west. These lands are protected by slave soldiers against the Dothraki horse lords, who sometimes test the Volantine defences and the other free cities, who attempt to grow stronger at the expense of their sister city.
While Volantine elections are mostly peaceful, there have been significant exceptions. Nicias Koheros's journals contain a report of the Triarch Horono, who had been returned as Triarch for 40 years running, for he was a great hero during the Century of Blood. After his 40th election, he declared himself Triarch for life, and though the Volantines loved him, they did not love him so much as to see their ancient customs and laws usurped for his ease. He was seized by rioters not long after, stripped of rank and title, and torn apart by war elephants.
Bravus. At the far northwestern corner of Essos, where the shivering sea and the narrow sea come together, the free city of Bravus stands upon its famed Hundred Isles, amidst the shallow brackish waters of a fog-shrouded lagoon. The youngest of the 9 free cities, Bravus, is also the wealthiest, and in all likelihood, the most powerful. Originally founded by escaped slaves, its humble beginnings were rooted in nothing more than a desire to be free. For a great part of its early history, its secret status made it of little consequence in the wider world. But in time it grew, eventually emerging as a power almost without rival. Neither prince nor king commands in Bravus, where the rule belongs to the Sea Lord, chosen by the city's magisters and keyholders from amongst the citizenry by a process as convoluted as it is arcane. From his vast waterside palace, the Sea Lord commands a fleet of warships second to none, and a mercantile fleet whose purple hulls and purple sails have become a common sight throughout the known world. Bravus was founded by fugitives from a large convoy of slave ships on its way from Valyria to a newly established colony in Sothoris, who rose in bloody rebellion, seized control of the ships on which they were being transported, and fled to the far ends of the earth to escape their erstwhile masters. Knowing they would be hunted, the slaves turned away from their intended destination and sailed north instead of south, seeking a refuge as far from Valyria and her vengeance as could be found. Bravusian histories claim that a group of slave women from the distant lands of the Jugus Nahai prophesied where they would find shelter, in a distant lagoon behind a wall of pine-clad hills and sea stones, where the frequent fogs would help to hide the refugees from the eyes of dragon riders passing overhead. And so it proved. These women were priestesses, called moon singers, and to this day the temple of the moon singers is the greatest in Bravus. Since the escaped slaves came from many lands and held many faiths, the founders of Bravus created a place where all gods were given their due and decreed that none would ever be made paramount over another. They were a diverse people, whose numbers included Andals, Summer Islanders, Gascari, Nathi, Roynar, Ebenese, Sonori, even debtors and criminals of pure Valyrian blood. Some had been trained in arms to serve as guardsmen and slave soldiers. Others were bed slaves, whose art was the giving of pleasure. There were many sorts of household slaves among them, tutors, nursemaids, cooks, grooms, and stewards. Others were skilled craftsmen, carpenters, armorers, masons and weavers. Some were fishermen, some field hands, some galley slaves, many common laborers. The new freedmen spoke many tongues, so the tongue of their late masters, Valyrian, became their common language. And because they had risked their lives in the name of freedom, the mothers and fathers of the new city vowed that no man, woman, or child in Bravus should ever be a slave, a thrall, or a bondsman. This is the first law, Bravus, engraved in stone on the arch that spans the Long Canal. From that day to this, the sea lords of Bravus have opposed slavery in all its forms, and have fought many a war against slavers and their allies. The lagoon where the fugitives found refuge seemed a drear and uninviting place of mud flats, tidal shallows, and salt marshes at first glance. But it was well hidden behind outlying islands and sea stacks, and often cloaked even from above by fog. Moreover, its brackish waters were rich with fish and shellfish of all sorts. The sheltering islands were thickly forested, and iron, tin, lead, slate, and other useful materials could be found nearby on mainland Essos. More crucially, the lagoon was remote and little visited. Though the escaped slaves were weary of flight, most of all they feared recapture. Undiscovered, Bravus grew and prospered. Farms, homes, and temples sprouted across the low-lying islands, while fishermen harvested the bounty of the great lagoon and the seas beyond. Amongst the other shellfish the Bravasi discovered was a certain sea snail, akin to those that had made Tyrosh and its dyes rich and famous. The snail yielded a dark purple dye. To change the look of their stolen ships, Bravasi captains dyed their sails this color whenever they sailed beyond the lagoon. Taking care to avoid Valerian ships and cities, wherever possible, the Bravasi began to trade with Ib, and later with the Seven Kingdoms. For a long while, however, Bravasi merchant ships carried false charts and practiced an artful deceit when questioned about their home port. Thus, for more than a century, Bravas was known as the Secret City. Sea Lord Uthro Zalin put an end to that secrecy, sending forth his ships to every corner of the world to proclaim the existence and location of Bravus, and invite men of all nations to celebrate the 111th festival of the city's founding. By that time, all of the original escaped slaves were dead, along with all their former masters. Even so, Uthro had sent envoys from the Iron Bank to Valeria several years prior to clear the way for what became known as the uncloaking or the unmasking of Uthro. The Dragon Lords proved to have little interest in the descendants of slaves who had escaped a century before, and the Iron Bank paid handsome settlements to the grandchildren of the men whose ships the founders had seized and sailed away, whilst refusing to pay for the value of the slaves themselves. Thus was accord achieved. The anniversary of the uncloaking is celebrated every year in Bravus, with 10 days of feasting and masked revelry, a festival like none other in all the known world, culminating at midnight on the 10th day, when the Titan roars and tens of thousands of revelers and celebrants remove their masks as one. Despite its humble origins, Bravus has not only become the wealthiest of the free cities, but also one of the most impregnable. Valentus may have its black walls, but Bravus has a wall of ships such as no other city in the world possesses. Lomas Longstrider marveled at the Titan of Bravus, the great fortress of stone and bronze in the shape of a warrior that bestrides the main entrance into the lagoon. But the true wonder is the arsenal. There, one of the purple hull wall galleys of Bravus can be built in a day. All the vessels are constructed following the same design, so that all the many parts can be prepared in advance, and skilled shipbuilders work upon different sections of the vessel simultaneously to hasten their labor. To organize such a feat of engineering is unprecedented. One need only look at the raucous, confused construction in the shipyards of Old Town to see the truth of this. It would be folly, however, not to give the Titan its due. With his proud head and fiery eyes looming close to 400 feet above the sea, the Titan is a fortress of a type never seen before or since, cast in the form of a huge giant, straddling two seamounts. The Titan's legs and lower torso are black granite, originally a natural stone archway carved and shaped by three generations of sculptors and stonemasons and wrapped in a pleated bronze skirt. Above the waist, the colossus is bronze, with green-dyed hemp for hair. When seen from the sea for the first time, the Titan is a sight terrifying to behold. His eyes are huge beacon fires, lighting the way for returning ships back inside the lagoon. Within his bronze body are halls and chambers, murder holes and arrow slits, such that any vessel that dared to force the passage would surely be destroyed. Enemy ships can easily be steered onto the rocks by the watchmen inside the Titan, and stones and pots of burning pitch can be dropped onto the decks of any that attempt to pass between the Titan's legs without leave. This has seldom been necessary, however. Not since the Century of Blood has any enemy been so rash as to attempt to provoke the Titan's wrath. Today, Braavos is one of the world's greatest ports and welcomes trading ships of all nations, save for slavers. Within the vast lagoon, Braavos' ships dock at the splendid Purple Harbor, located near the Sea Lord's Palace. Other vessels must use the port called the Ragman's Harbor, a poorer and rougher port by all accounts. Still, there is so much wealth to be had in Braavos that ships come from as far as Carth and the Summer Isles to trade there. Braavos is also the home to one of the most powerful banks in the world, whose roots stretch back to the beginnings of the city, when a few of the fugitives took to hiding such valuables as they had in an abandoned iron mine to keep them safe from thieves and pirates. As the city grew and prospered, the shafts and chambers of the mine began to fill. Rather than let their treasure sit idle in the earth, the wealthier Braavos began to make loans to their less fortunate brethren. Thus was born the Iron Bank of Braavos, whose renown, or infamy, to hear some tell it, now extends to every corner of the known world. Kings, princes, archons, triarchs, and merchants beyond count travel from the ends of the earth to seek loans from the heavily guarded vaults of the Iron Bank. The Iron Bank will have its due, it is said. Those who borrow from the Braavos and fail to repay their debts oft have cause to rue such folly, for the bank has been known to topple lords and princes and has also been rumored to send assassins against those it cannot remove, though this has never been conclusively proved.
Archmaester Mathars, The Origins of the Iron Bank and Braavos, provides one of the more detailed accounts of the bank's history and dealings, so far as they can be discovered. The bank is famous for its discretion and its secrecy. Mathar recounts that the founders of the Iron Bank numbered 23, 16 men and 7 women, each of whom possessed a key to the bank's great subterranean vaults. Their descendants, whose numbers now exceed 1,000, are known as keyholders to this day, though the keys they display proudly on formal occasions are now entirely ceremonial. Certain of the founding families of Braavos have declined over the centuries, and a few have lost their wealth entirely. Yet even the meanest still cling to their keys and the honors that go with them. The Iron Bank is not ruled by the keyholders alone, however. Some of the wealthiest and most powerful families in Braavos today are of more recent vintage. Yet the heads of these houses own shares in the bank, sit on its secret councils, and have a voice in selecting the men who lead it. In Braavos, as many an outsider has observed, golden coins count for more than iron keys. The bank's envoys cross the world, oft upon the bank's own ships, and merchants, lords, and even kings treat with them almost as equals.
Braavos is a city built on mud and sand, where a man is never more than a few feet from the water. Some say the city has more canals than streets. This is an exaggeration, yet it cannot be denied that the swiftest way to move about the city is over water. In one of the myriad serpent boats that ply the canals, rather than by foot, through the maze of streets, alleyways, and arched bridges. Pools and fountains are seen everywhere in Braavos, celebrating the city's ties to the sea and the wooden walls that defend her. The brackish water of the lagoon that surrounds the Hundred Isles were the source of much of the city's early wealth, yielding up oysters, eels, crabs, crawfish, clams, rays, and many sorts of fish. Yet the waters that nourish and protect Braavos also imperil her, for during the past two centuries it has become apparent that some of the city's islands are sinking under the weight of the buildings that now cover them. The oldest part of the city just north of the Ragman's Harbour has in fact already sunk and is now known as the Drowned Town. Even so, there are still some Braavosi of the poorer sort who dwell in the towers and upper floors of its half-submerged buildings. Braavos is a city renowned for its architecture. The sprawling Sea Lord's Palace, with its magnificent menagerie of queer beasts and birds from all around the world. The imposing Palace of Justice, the huge Temple of the Moon Singers, the aqueduct that the Braavosi named the Sweet Water River, carrying much-needed fresh water from the mainland of Essos, for the water in the canals is brackish, muddy, and too foul to drink because of the refuse thrown into it by the city's inhabitants. The towers of the keyholders and noble families, and the House of Red Hands, a great hospice and center of healing. In and amongst these noble structures are countless shops, brothels, inns, alehouses, guild halls, and merchants' exchanges. Along the streets and bridges stand statues of past sea lords, lawgivers, sailors, warriors, even poets, singers, and courtesans. The temples of Braavos are far famed as well, and some are truly wonders to behold. The Temple of the Moon Singers is the foremost of these, for the Braavosi have a particular reverence for that deity, as previously recounted. The Father of Waters is almost as venerated. His watery temple is built anew each year for his feast days. The Lord of Light, Red Relor, has a great temple on Braavos as well, for his worshippers have grown ever more numerous in the past 100 years. Descended from 100 different peoples, the Braavosi honor 100 different gods. The greatest of these have temples, but deep in the heart of the city can be found the Isle of the Gods, where even the least of the gods have temples. The Sept beyond the sea, and its septons and scepters, offer worship to the seven every day for sailors off the ships from the seven kingdoms that come to Braavos to trade. In Braavos, men and women from far-flung corners of the world may sit together, as they have done for hundreds of years, eating and drinking and telling tales. All are welcome in the secret city, it is said. It must also be said that the courtesans of Braavos are renowned throughout the world, yet are all free women, unlike the more famous beauties of the pleasure gardens of Lys and the brothels of Valantis. Their art is not only for the bedchamber, their wit and their bearing make them much sought after by the richest merchants, the boldest captains, the most distinguished visitors. Keyholders, lords, and princes seek their favors. The most famous courtesans take poetic names that add to their allure and mystery. Singers vie for their patronage, whilst the bravas with their slender swords often duel to the death in the name of a courtesan.
Many of the courtesans of Braavos are celebrated in song and story, and a few have even been immortalized in bronze or marble. In the Seven Kingdoms, the most storied and infamous of these are the Black Pearls. The first woman to bear that name was the captain and pirate queen Bellegaire Othrys, who reigned briefly as one of the nine paramours of King Aegon IV Targaryen, and bore him a bastard daughter, Belinora, the second Black Pearl, a famous courtesan acclaimed by the singers of her day as the most beautiful woman in all the world. Her descendants became courtesans as well, each in turn known as the Black Pearl, and each having in her veins some measure of the blood of the dragon to this very day.
The swordsmanship of the Braavos of the Secret City is as famed as the beauty of her courtesans. Largely unarmored and wielding slender, pointed blades, far lighter than the long swords of the Seven Kingdoms, these warriors of the streets practice a swift, deadly style of fighting. The greatest Braavos call themselves water dancers, given the custom of dueling upon the moon pool near the Sea Lord's Palace. It is claimed that true water dancers can fight and kill upon the pool surface without disturbing the water itself.
Pilman of Lannisport, a ship's captain, provided an account of a water dancer duel to the citadel. The water dancers, he tells us, do seem to barely skim upon the surface, but it is an illusion caused by the darkness, for they always duel at night. The captain insisted he never saw anything like it for grace or skill, however.
Though many a deadly swordsman can be found amongst the Braavos and water dancers, by tradition the greatest of them all is the First Sword, who commands the personal guard of the Sea Lord and protects his person at all public events. Once chosen, Sea Lords serve for life. Inevitably, there are always those who wish to cut that life short to effect some change in policy. Through the centuries, the First Swords have fought many famous duels, taken part in a dozen wars, and saved the lives of scores of Sea Lords for good and ill.
No discussion of Braavos would be complete without a mention of the Faceless Men. Shrouded in mystery and rumor, this secretive society of assassins is said to be older than Braavos itself, with roots that go back to Valyria at the height of its glory. Little is known for certain about these killers, however.
Beyond the Free Cities. Do we know all the lands and peoples who exist in the world? Surely we do not. Our maps have their limits, and even the finest of them raise as many questions as they answer about the far lands to the east, featuring all too frequent blank spaces where we have no knowledge. Yet it may profit us much to discuss something of those places we do know, even if their commerce with the Seven Kingdoms is small at best compared to that of the Free Cities. The Summer Isles. South of Westeros, cradled in the deep blue waters of the summer sea, the Summer Isles bask in the warm southern sun. More than 50 islands make up this verdant archipelago, many so small a man could walk across them in an hour. But Jala, largest of the isles, stretches 200 leagues from tip to tip. Beneath its towering green mountains are vast forests, steaming jungles, beaches of green and black sand, mighty rivers teeming with monstrous crocodiles, and fertile vales. Wolano and Amburu, though less than half the size of Jala, are each larger than all the stepstones combined. These three islands are home to more than 9/10 of the people of the Isles. Flowers of 1,000 different sorts bloom in profusion on the summer isles, filling the air with their perfume. The trees are heavy with exotic fruits, and a myriad of brightly colored birds flitter through the skies. From their plumage, the summer islanders make their fabulous feathered cloaks. Beneath the green canopies of the rainforests, prowl spotted panthers larger than any lion and packs of lean red wolves. Tribes of monkeys swing through the branches of the trees above. Apes abound as well. The old red men of Amboro, silver pelts in the mountains of Jala, night stalkers on Wolano.
Lomas Longstrider, who visited the Summer Isles in his search for wonders, recorded that the sages of the Isles claimed that their ancestors once reached the western shores of Sothorius and founded cities there, only to have them overwhelmed and destroyed by the same forces that wiped out later Giscari and Valyrian settlements on that perilous continent. The Citadel's archives hold a few ancient chronicles of Valyria, but none speak of these supposed cities, and there are maesters who cast doubts on the truth of these claims.
The Summer Islanders are a dark people, black of hair and eye, with skins as brown as teak or as black as polished jet. For much of their recorded history, they lived in isolation from the rest of mankind. Their earliest maps, as carved into the famous Talking Trees of Tall Trees Town, show no lands but the isles themselves, surrounded by a vast world-spanning ocean. As islanders, they took to the seas in the dawn of days, first in oared coracles, then in larger, swifter ships with sails of woven hemp. Yet few ever ventured beyond the sight of their own shores, and those who sailed beyond the horizons did not always return. The first recorded contact between the Summer Isles and the wider world occurred at the height of the old empire of Gis. A Giscari merchant ship made landfall on Wolano after being blown off course by a storm, only to flee in terror at the first sight of the local inhabitants, whom the Giscari took for demons with skins burned black by the fires of hell. Thereafter, Giscari sailors took care to stay well away from the Demon Isle, as they named Wolano on their charts. They had no inkling of the existence of Amboro, Jala, or the Lesser Isles. This contact had a profound effect upon the Summer Islanders themselves, for it proved that other peoples lived in the lands beyond the waves. Their curiosity and avarice thus awakened, the princes of the Isles began to build larger and stronger ships, capable of carrying sufficient provisions to cross long stretches of ocean whilst withstanding even the fiercest storms at sea. Malthazak, a prince of the small island of Koj, was the greatest of these shipbuilders, and is remembered today as Malthar the Windrider and Malthar the Mapmaker. A new era of exploration and trade began as the great ships struck out across the waters, dispatched by Malthar and his fellow princes. Many did not return. More did. Nath, the Basilisk Isles, the northern coasts of Sothorius, and the southern coasts of both Westeros and Essos were all visited, and within less than half a century, a thriving trade had grown up between the Summer Isles and the freehold of Valyria. The islands lacked iron, tin, and other metals, but were rich in gemstones, emeralds, rubies, and sapphires, and pearls of many sorts, spice, nutmeg, cinnamon, pepper, and hardwoods. A fashion developed amongst the dragon lords for monkeys, apes, panther cubs, and parrots. Bloodwood, ebony, mahogany, purple heart, blue mahoe, Burl, Tigerwood, Goldenheart, Pink Ivory, and other rare and precious woods were also much in demand, along with palm wine, fruit, and feathers.
Maester Gallard's Children of Summer remains a chief source on the history of the Summer Isles. Much of the history, which was once obscured by the fact that so many of the Summer Isles' histories were recorded in highly complicated, formal verse, have been rendered quite clear by his exhaustive efforts. Though certain controversies remain, Mollo's questioning of Gallard's chronology of the early princes of Wallano being one example, no better work on the subject has appeared.
The Valerians offered gold for slaves as well. Then as now, the Summer Islanders were a handsome people, tall, strong, graceful, and quick to learn. These qualities drew pirates and slavers from Valeria, the Basilisk Isles, and Old Gis. Much woe ensued as these raiders descended on peaceful villages to carry their inhabitants into bondage. For a time, the princes of the Isles abetted this trade by selling captured foes and rivals to the slavers. The histories carved into the talking trees tell us that these years of shame endured for the better part of two centuries, until a warrior woman named Xander Co, princess of Sweet Lotus Vale, who had herself been enslaved for a time, united all the islands under her rule and made an end to it. As iron was scarce and costly in the isles, armor was little known, and the long thrusting spears and short stabbing spears, traditional amongst the Summer Islanders, had proved a little worth against the steel swords and axes of the slavers. So Xander Co armed her sailors with tall bows of golden heart, a wood found only on Jala and Amburo. These great bows far outranged the recurve bows of horn and sinew the slavers carried, and could throw a yard-long shaft hard enough to pierce through mail and boiled leather and even good steel plate. To give her archers a solid platform from which to draw and loose, Xander Co built ships larger than any previously seen in the summer sea. Tall, graceful ships, cunningly fit together without so much as a single nail. Many-walled, with rare hardwoods of the isles made harder still with magics. So the rams of slavers' ships cracked and splintered against their sides. As swift as they were strong, her ships off-sported tall, curved prows carved into the shapes of birds and beasts. These swan necks won them the sobriquet of swan ships. Though it took the best part of a generation, the Summer Islanders, led by Princess Xander's daughter and eventual successor, Chitana Co, the Arrow of Jahar, ultimately prevailed in what came to be known as the Slavers' Wars. Though the unity of the Isles did not survive her own reign, for the Arrow wed unwisely and did not rule as well as she had fought. Slavers even now will flee at the sight of a swan ship, for each of these proud vessels is known to carry a complement of deadly archers armed with golden heart bows. To this day, the bowmen and women of the Summer Isles are esteemed the finest in the world, nor can their bows be matched by common bows, for the princes of the Isles have forbidden the export of golden heart wood since the slavers' wars. Only bows of dragon bone are known to surpass them, and those are exceedingly rare. Certain Summer Islanders with a desire to see the wider world have been known to take up service abroad as mercenary bowmen and sail-sails. Others have joined the pirates of the Basilisk Isles. Some became captains of dark renown, whose deeds are spoken of with dread in ports as distant as Carth and Oldtown. Summer Islanders have risen high amongst the free companies of the disputed lands, as guardsmen in the retinues of the merchant princes of the free cities, or as pit fighters in the slave cities of Astapor, Yunkai, and Nirin. But despite the undoubted prowess and skill at arms they display as individuals, the islanders are not a warlike people. The Summer Islanders have never once invaded any lands beyond their own shores, nor attempted the conquest of any foreign people. Their great swan ships sail farther and faster than the vessels of any other nation, to the very ends of the earth. Yet the princes of the Summer Islands have no warships as such, and seem to prefer trade and exploration to conquest. Throughout their long history, the Summer Islands have been united under a single ruler no more than half a dozen times, and never for long. Today, each of the smaller islands has its own ruler, styled as a prince or princess in the common tongue. The larger islands, Jala, Amboru, and Wolano, oft have several rival princes. Nonetheless, the Isles are, by and large, a peaceful place. Such wars as are fought there are highly ritualized, with battles that resemble tawny melees, wherein bands of warriors meet on battlefields chosen and consecrated in advance, at times deemed auspicious by their priests. They fight with spears and slings and wooden shields, just as their forebears did 5,000 years ago. The golden heart bows and yard-long shafts carried by their archers into battle against foes from across the sea are never used against their own people, for their gods have forbidden this. Wars on the Summer Isle seldom last longer than a day, and do no harm to any but the warriors themselves. No crops are destroyed, no homes are put to the torch, no cities are sacked, no children are harmed, no women are raped, though warrior women oft fight beside their men in the line of battle. Even the defeated princes suffer neither death nor disfigurement, though they must leave their homes and palaces to spend the remainder of their days in exile. Though Jala is the largest of the Summer Isles, Wolano is the most populous. There can be found Last Lament, with its great harbour, sleepy Lotus Point, and sun-dappled Tall Trees Town, where priestesses in feathered robes carve songs and stories into the trunks of the enormous tower trees that shade the town. On these talking trees can be read the whole history of the Summer Islanders, together with the commandments of their many gods and the laws by which they live their lives. Though a score of gods, both great and small, are honored on the Summer Isles, a special reverence is shown to the god and goddess of love, beauty, and fertility. The union of male and female is sacred to these deities. By joining together in this act of worship, the islanders believe men and women give honor to the gods who made them. Be they rich or poor, male or female, of high birth or low, all Summer Islanders are expected to dwell for a time in the temples of love that dot the islands, sharing their bodies with any who might desire them. Most serve the gods for no more than a year, but those deemed the most beautiful, the most compassionate, and the most skilled remain. In Braavos they might be called courtesans, while in King's Landing they were thought no more than whores. But on Jala, Wolano, Amboro, and the other isles, these priests and priestesses are much esteemed, for here the giving of carnal pleasure is regarded as an art, as worthy of respect as music, sculpture, or dance. Today the Summer Islanders are a common sight in Old Town and King's Landing, and the swan ships, with their billowing clouds of sails, traverse all the seas of earth. Bold mariners, their captains scorn to hug the coast like other seafarers, but instead strike out fearlessly across the ocean deeps, far from the sight of land. There are certain indications that explorers from Koj may well have mapped the western coasts of Sothorius to the very bottom of the world, and discovered strange lands and stranger peoples far to the south, or across the endless waters of the Sunset Sea. But the truth of these tales is known only to the princes of the isles and the captains who serve them.
The Other Summer Isles. Whilst Jala, Wilano, and Omboru dominate the archipelago, a number of the smaller isles are worthy of mention. The Singing Stones, west of the main isles, have jagged peaks so riddled with holes and airways that they make a strange music when the wind blows. The people of the stones can tell which way the wind is blowing from the sound of their song. Whether gods or men taught the stones to sing, no one can say. Stonehead, the northernmost island in the chain, is plainly the work of men. The north face of this sea-girt rock has been carved in the stern likeness of some forgotten god, glowering out across the sea. His is the last visage that summer islanders see as they sail north to Westeros. Cooge, once home to Malfur the mapmaker, still boasts the finest shipyards in the archipelago. Three-quarters of the islanders' famed swan ships are built on Cooge, and the Pearl Palace, seat of the princes of Cooge, is renowned for its collection of charts and maps. Abulu, a small desolate isle northeast of Wilano, served for more than 2 years as home to Nymeria and her followers. The princes of the isles refused to allow her to settle on the larger islands for fear of waking the wrath of Valyria. As most of Nymeria's people were female, Abulu became known as the Isle of Women, a name it still bears today. Disease, hunger, and slave raids took a steady toll of the Rhoynar there, until finally Nymeria led her 10,000 ships back to sea in search of a new refuge. A few thousand of her followers chose to remain behind, however, and their descendants remain on the Isle of Women to this day.
Nath. Northwest of Sothorius in the summer sea lies the mysterious island of Nath, known to the ancients as the Isle of Butterflies. The people native to the island are a beautiful and gentle race, with round, flat faces, dusky skin, and large, soft, amber eyes, off-flecked with gold. The peaceful people, the Nathi are called by seafarers, for they will not fight even in defense of their homes and persons. The Nathi do not kill, not even beasts of the field and wood. They eat fruit, not flesh, and make music, not war. The god of Nath is called the Lord of Harmony, oft shown as a laughing giant, bearded and naked, always attended by swarms of slender maidens with butterfly wings. 100 varieties of butterflies flitter about the island. The Nathi revere them as messengers of the Lord, charged with the protection of his people. Mayhaps there is some truth to these legends, for whilst the docile nature of the Nathi seem to make their island ripe for conquest, strangers from beyond the sea do not live long upon the Isle of Butterflies. The Gascari seized the island thrice in the days of the old empire. The Valyrians erected a fort there, whose walls of fused dragonstone can still be seen. A company of Valentine adventurers once built a trade town, complete with timber palisades and slave pens. Corsairs from the Basilisk Isles have landed on Nath countless times, yet none of these invaders survived, and the Nathi claim that none lasted more than a year. For some evil humor lurks in the very air of this fair isle, and all those who linger too long on Nath soon succumb. Fever is the first sign of this plague, followed by painful spasms that make it seem as if victims are dancing wildly and uncontrollably. In the last stage, the afflicted sweat blood, and their flesh sloughs from their bones. The Na'vi themselves are seemingly untroubled by the illness.